Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Cameroon is a West African nation that is embroiled in a civil war between its Anglophone and Francophone populations. What are the causes of war? What are the prospects for resolution? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Cameroon is a state that was born out of two different colonies, French Cameroon and British Cameroon. It's a nation that is officially bilingual with distinctly different regions, but French Cameroonians have dominated the post-independence politics. Yet there's a federal structure within the country that grants local rule to Anglophone Cameroonians. But the central government has not always recognized this federalist system. And in 2016 and 2017, Anglophone Cameroonians protested this lack of political representation and the infringement of their rights by the central government. The government responds with violence, and what emerges and erupts is a war that we now call the Ambazonia War or the Cameroonian Civil War. This is a war that has left thousands dead, and UNICEF estimates that as many as 1.3 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance. On today's show, we discuss the foundations and roots of this war, its impact on the people on southern Cameroon, and the prospect for some form of conflict resolution. Our guests are Patricia Asongwe, visiting lecturer at the National School of Administration and Magistry in Cameroon, and Laura Tufan, consultant expert to conflict sensitivity for Catholic Relief Services, Caritas, Archdiocese of Bamenda. She is a founding member of the Network of Civil Peace Service in Cameroon. I want to thank you both for joining us. Dr. Asongwe, I'm going to ask you the first question. What is the nature of this conflict? I kind of broadly referenced grievances and marginalization. What causes this conflict to erupt?
The nature changes. From 2016 to 2017, the crisis was a peaceful reclamation, people reclaiming their rights, social professional groups, and the villagers at the community level. It was a peaceful reclamation of what they consider to be their rights, the right to the, as per the Fumban Conference that was signed between the French-speaking and the English-speaking Cameroon. So the English-speaking Cameroonians, especially the socio-professional groups, were claiming that those rights were not respected. So from 2016 to 2017, it was a peaceful reclamation from the English-speaking zone. That's the Northwest and the Southwest region. But when it got to 2017, it went on to arms conflicts, but at a low-key level. It was from 2018 that it skyrocketed. And as from today, you have factions. You have people, the real people that went in because they were reclaiming their rights. You have people that are going in for business purposes. You have thieves, you have jealousy, and you have not. All what you can imagine that goes on now at this level of 2021. And as for now, you will hardly pick out those that have a genuine reason for reclaiming their rights. So for now, it is a sad situation in Cameroon because it will be difficult for you to differentiate the various factions. Even those that call themselves the leader for the Ambazonian, they are not able to control the armed conflict that is going on now. So it's we can only pray that we go to the tables and be able to pick out those who are not there for the genuine reason. Those who are out for business, who are out for jealousy, who are out for hatred. And that is what is reigning in the society, especially at the village level, at the community level, that each person knows the other. So it is no longer a sociopolitical aspect now as it started, but it has taken another turn. It's taken another twist. And we are seeing that unless we resume these problems now, it's going to go to another level. And we expect and we pray that the problem we should table, but solutions to the table.
So, Laura Tufrang, it sounds then that this was originally an issue of political representation and respective rights that yes. has now become transformed into a conflict that then has complicated this relationship. First of all, what were the nature of some of these rights, the rights that were being deprived and the grievances that Anglophone Cameroonians had against the central state?
The nature of grievances are political. There is an established political marginalization. The representation at instances of power are so limited when it comes to the Northwest and the Southwest. At the Fumban conference that Patricia indicated, it was that conference that brought the two Cameroons together. And there were some basic agreements at that time. And one of them was that the constitution that stated that Cameroon is a federal state shall not be touched. That position shall not be touched. But after that conference, things changed. Cameroon was, first of all, when they came together, it was a united, it was a federal republic, then turned to a united republic, and then turned to the Republic of Cameroon, which means the French section of Cameroon was a republic before coming together to a federal republic and a unitary state, and then back. So now the Anglophones feel they were marginalized by the sudden change of name without prior consultation. And even the electoral process, governance as a whole, whether it's through elections or accountability, it really destroyed Anglophones' feel. Those that live then and the children that are growing up in this generation, they feel that there is no clear rules for accountability. We just had very scandalous situation in Cameroon where COVID loans acquired to address the COVID pandemic were just embezzled like that. And that is how it has always been with the French part of Cameroon. So people are saying, no, at the beginning of it all, at the beginning of this crisis in 2016, the civil rights activists that started the conflict, they said, no, let's go back to a federal state. Let's go back. It's not working. It has not worked. We are assimilated. You just want to assimilate us into the French system of education and everything. So we want to go back. They said, no, that they will not touch the form of state and all of that. And now newspapers are sounding that they may go back to a federal form of state. But it's unfortunate. The violence is at its highest peak. People have ceased to be human beings. And how do you sit down those people to reason? First, at the very first, in 2016, the government denied that there was no problem. There is no problem. There's no Anglophone problem. And generally, history has shown that when this denial starts, those are basis of discrimination. Accept, acknowledge that there is a problem, and let's see how to go about it. This has always been the repressive method that the central government has done, always repression. But unfortunately, in 2016 or this year, the 2000s, the young people now, they have opportunities that the other generation never had to use, like the social media and all of that. So they were able to fight back and have continued to fight back till today. About almost a million children are not going to school for 4 years. They have not gone to school for 4 years. And if we want to understand that, it is the responsibility of the state for children, for the citizens to be educated. And the state has not been able to accept that responsibility. It's a really, really, really difficult thing. I live and work in the Northwest, which seems to be the epicenter of violence, of the conflict itself. Because we have 7 divisions in the Northwest. And out of those 7 divisions, I can't tell you 2 of these divisions function up to 50%. No, They don't function up to 50%. Some areas function very well. Children go to school in assorted dressing, unlike they used to do. And then life is so, for example, yesterday when I was coming back from work, there was an explosion. So I had to wait and let clear the air. And to begin with, you can't wait till a certain hour because you will be vulnerable even to the military men who patrol the streets or the armed fighters. So it's life has been so, so horrible. And back in the communities, as Patricia rightly said, it is, of course, in times like this, in times of civil wars, you know, there is criminality, there is also settling of scores and all of that. So it is difficult. It means Cameroon is in a fragile state and nothing really works, nothing at all. I am not missing my word, nothing really works. But we still see in the bilingual country documents leaving the presidency of the republic only in one language. You still see horrible translations from French to English. There is no accountability. Nobody takes responsibility. It's just like that. Yes, the commission, which is supposed to be overlooking all of that, but I've not had anybody punished for not using the language well or not being bilingual.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the ongoing Anglophone crisis and Cameroon civil war with Patricia Asangwe and Laura Tufan. Patricia, you have a response to Laura's description of the nature of this crisis that's been going on.
I was just saying that when something hurts the finger, it hurts the whole body. So the effect of the impact of this crisis cannot be limited just to the north and the northwest and southwest regions of the country. The economy has gone low. Today in Cameroon, if you look at the economic sector, you look even at the higher education sector where I work, there is a great impact. The quality of study has gone low. It has been affected. Why? Because you have an influx from students coming in from the war-torn areas and the universities where they have a bit of peace has been highly populated without the corresponding number of lecturers or instructors, resulting to a drop in the quality of education. We've made efforts to go online, to use online virtual studies, but now you cannot go virtual when there is no security. There must be accessibility, there must be affordability. The students must be able to get the material when they want to. With the infrastructures, we have erratic cuts of electricity, and that hinders the virtual learning that we want to migrate to. It is a policy that education in Cameroon has to migrate online. But where is the security? Where are the infrastructures to guarantee the online education? Going to the economic sector, if you look at the borders, because of the COVID, the borders to Nigeria was blocked, to Equatorial Guinea was blocked, to Chad was blocked, therefore having an adverse effect on the economy. Cameroon is the country, is the heartbeat of Central Africa. We supply goods to all the neighbor landlocked countries, but because of the COVID, we couldn't do what we could do. So when you take the economic crisis, the sociopolitical crisis in the Northwest and the Southwest region, coupled with the COVID, it has affected Cameroon doubly as compared to the other countries in the Central African region. If you look at the social aspect of the crisis, you see young girls being sexually harassed. You see children of about 9 years hawking on the street just to get what to eat. You see children separated from their parents because of the war. Some do not even know where the parents are. So if you go to a restaurant in the main towns of Yaoundé and Douala, you see little girls selling there, saving as, and what comes out of little girls selling in hotels and restaurants, you can just imagine. So the impact is as numerous as we cannot even imagine. I always end up by saying that a solution is needed immediately speedy solutions to these problems.
So Laura, previously, when you outlined the causes of this conflict, I think we could say there's three main causes. The violation of the federalism agreement and the local rule of Anglophone Cameroon, the lack of Anglophone representation in the central government, and then issues of corruption. Could you elaborate in particular on the federalism question?
You know, Anglophones lived in their federal state and they managed everything, but when they came together, everything was transferred to Yaoundé. They had three airports. One was international. There was an airport in Tiko, there was one in Bissongabang, there was one in Bali.
Bamenda, but in Bamenda.
Everything was transferred to Yaoundé. If an Anglophone leaves the US, you must either come through Yaoundé or Douala. So we had a good transport system, but everything diminished. We had a flourishing economy with a deep sea port in Limbe and another one in Tiko, but everything was just bundled and forgotten about. That's how it ended. Of course, with the non-respect of bilingualism in the public sector, nothing is changing much. All is not bleak because government tried, but unfortunately, it was too late. The grievances had gone so deep. You cannot imagine someone telling you, I have this problem. Look, my children cannot continue to be taught by a French-speaking person. I am an Anglophone. You teach the child you are a Francophone. You teach the child in a broken English. And during examination, their questions come in French. So how do you expect that child to match up with the Francophone child? It wasn't going. And government said, no, there is no problem. They cannot do anything, blah, 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 blah. And all of that, and started their repression. Well, after that, they tried. Well, government acknowledges, but especially the French governments, they acknowledge, but they wouldn't come out clearly until the case that is very glaring in Rwanda, that the French president apologized. They wouldn't come out clearly, but they tried to create some commissions, but those were shallow. We needed to sit on the table, talk about our differences and see how we can mend them. You don't give me what I don't want. They created some commissions. One of the commissions is the one in which David works. And then they tried, when we talk so much about, the world talks so much about dialogue, the government organized a dialogue session at the level of the capital in Yaoundé. And they decided who to come for the session, the dialogue session. And even when you came, you didn't have much to do because we used to think that we had resources for peace. But unfortunately, the politics of the government destroyed everything. For example, the church. So at the Grand National Dialogue, you could see people, respectable people like the Cardinal, may he so rest in peace, who had struggled to pave a way for dialogue and it wasn't coming. He left the National Dialogue Forum so disappointed because nothing they discussed came out. Government had a pre-planned outcome resolution from the dialogue. And that is what they have been trying to implement, but it's not gaining ground. They also tried to create, Patricia would bear with me. Patricia is a magistrate, I'm sure. There is a bench at the Supreme Court for Anglophones.
Can you give me a minute, Laura?
Yes, please, go ahead.
Please. I was just about to talk about the cultural background of the two parts of Cameroon, which is also a fundamental problem. Reasons why in 2016, you had lawyers, they call themselves common law lawyers, were on the street in 2016. Why? Because there is a core principle with the English law department or the common law. Those of us who are brought up in the English system, there is this presumption of innocence. And that is the core of the English law justice system. But when you come to the French system, they don't acknowledge that principle. They give little regards to that. They give little regards to fair justice. That's the fundamental reason why the common law lawyers went on the street in 2016, coupled with the fact that the Ojada law of 1996 and 97 did not bring in the common law principles, but were basically on the civil law principles. So that has gone and has affected the university studies, because when you go to one of the universities, they will say this is a French-speaking university, and you can barely have the Anglo-Saxon tradition in that university. You have students that come in from the English-speaking region, and when they come to the University of Yaoundé, they do well. But when they go out with a degree, but they write competitive exams into the professional schools, like the School of Magistracy, like the police, you see their system of handling matters, their system of assessing their questions and responding to questions are not the same way as we are being taught in the English-speaking region. So that is still creating a faction. It's still creating a problem within the higher education system. All is not bad, like Laura said. From 2016 to 2021, you have some schools that are being created in the University of Bamenda, Higher Institution of Polytechnic, you have Higher Institution of Transport and whatever, but you still have a massive influx from the French-speaking region going to occupy the space of our children in the Northwest and Southwest region that cannot even find a place into ENAM or School of Police. So you see, there is still that problem in the higher education system and the legal system. And when you go to courts, now they've opened a branch in the School of Magistracy where I teach. They say common law section. And they say Cameroon is a bilingual section. It's a bilingual country. When they train a student that comes out of the School of Magistracy as a lawyer, and they've said they've opened a common law section, where is the student going to be posted? Is it in the Northwest region, the Southwest region? Of course not. You still have their magistrate from Yaoundé, their magistrate from Douala. You still have their bailiffs from Douala and Yaoundé being sent to head all the infrastructures in Bamenda, nearly all, let me not exaggerate, most of the infrastructures in Bamenda and in the Northwest and the Southwest region. So we still have a very, very, very fundamental problem with the legal system and the educational system in Cameroon that needs to be resolved, else this crisis will find little opportunity to get solved.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the ongoing civil war and political crisis in Cameroon with Patricia Asangwe and Laura Tufan. So Patricia Asangwe, a lot of what we're describing here are political challenges. There are questions about governance, you know, certainly questions about the relationship between the regions and the central government. But the war has complicated these issues. The government is citing justification for the use of military force based on issues like the global war on terror, the impact that Boko Haram can have in the Anglophone regions, et cetera. How much has war complicated the resolution of this political crisis? And how much more difficult is it going to be to resolve this?
For now, I think it depends on the will of the government. It's quite difficult. It's a pretty difficult situation, because if the government is willing to resolve this problem, the government will start from a level. What level is the government going to start? Is from bringing those people, those guys from the bushes, because those guys from the bushes, that
Yes, it's important.
Is the will of the government. And how does the government start? The government has to start from the level of negotiating a peaceful negotiation, whatever means it's going to take, by using the churches, using the traditional rulers and the head of the families, head of the quarters, because those guys in the bushes, they're family members. They belong to a family, they belong to a community. When they come out of that, that is the beginning. And then the government has another will at the level of the regions. They can start by resolving the problems from there, putting out their desiderata. What do they want? What do they think that if they give them, this war can come to an end? They get it from mm-hmm. there, so that it should be a harmonized demand. The desiderata should be harmonized so that it moves in steps and it comes to the national. And why not bringing an international third party to come and mediate? I think it is the will of the government. If the government is willing to do it, the government will do it.
Laura Tufan, your response.
I just finished the conference this morning. I had a presentation on the rights of minorities. It was a UN forum. And you see, when I was presenting, I thought it was only Cameroon that is going through such problems. But I realized that other countries, not only in Africa, but other countries with minorities in the world are going through the same problems. In the 1880s, when during the Berlin Conference, when Africa was pieced out by Germany, you know, they didn't consider the linguistic, cultural capacity of the people that were dividing.
Background of the people.
Yes, yes. So that is where it is difficult. And you see, and the people, especially French and English, the people, when they were as Cameroon was their colony, the people they put on to take over them were people they put to rule over the people. It was not like ruling with the people, government with the people. It was ruling, just ruling over the people. And that is how it has continued. So if I take on from where Patricia spoke, talking about the means to maybe bring the situation to normalcy, it will end, the conflict will end someday. But then we need a leadership that must be able to lead people to find a solution. The leadership we have is too old. Can you imagine that Cameroon has been there for almost 60 years, if not more than, but we are only in our second president. And the president is everything but president for Cameroonians. So we don't see him, he doesn't say anything. People are fighting and killing themselves, nothing, he doesn't say anything. COVID has come, it's ravaging, he doesn't say anything. Is in his class. So if you don't have a leadership, and I'm very certain that even his ministers, his close associates, do not know his mind. You know, when a regime is tired, is old and tired, and is appointing or getting people in their circles only of the same ages, what do you expect? You have youth that are literate, they've gone to universities with high degrees, that are sleeping in the streets, they are riding bikes. What do you expect from a country like that? So it is really sad, but all is not lost because we have local initiatives for peace. If they really want to work and make peace happen, you know, at the grassroots, we know who to touch. Yes, people have been displaced, but there are still some people there. We know who to touch. There are organizations that have been working. There are women's organizations that have carried out a lot of activities. There are NGOs, civil society that have carried out a lot of work on the ground. But in a situation like this, in a polarized situation like this, who takes responsibility? I may be going, arranging for a workshop in one of the villages just for social cohesion or for early recovery. And I am arrested by either the gendarme or the chief of brigade or the police or the military that I'm bringing secessionist ideas. You see, who takes leadership in such a polarized situation? Because if you are beginning any initiative, we always cover it under, give it an umbrella name, just cover it. If you say you are talking about early recovery, okay, it's understood. But I'm working on peace. I'm working with women. I cannot talk aloud because how do you address these issues aloud? I cannot give a radio conference on what we are doing. I cannot allow the women give. There is sexual exploitation. You know the perpetrators. They are the military people. You cannot speak aloud because you are even afraid of the victim. They can exterminate the survivor. So how do you, who takes responsibility? I understand that in situations of war, the governments must be humble enough to take responsibility. A government, military, kill and kill women, shoot and kill women, massacre women, pregnant women, and children, and deny it in the face of logic. How do you cope with such people? Mm. Yes, I know the Amazonian fighters also equally committed atrocities. But who signed the conventions, the international conventions? Mm. Who signed the human rights? It's the government. It's the responsibility of the government. Yes, they would have, when time comes, everybody will be held to account. But the major person who thinks they will always flag that principle of sovereignty, that's the government, and not let people know, come into her responsibility to protect citizens. For me, it's a principle that it's just overwhelming. Everybody knows that there is a conflict in Cameroon. Everybody knows that we have more than 4,000 deaths, whether it's for civilians. They just killed, there was a kidnap of six divisional delegates in one of the divisions in the Southwest, and they killed one of the delegates already. These are government, these are civil servants. Nobody takes responsibility. Nobody does anything. You send them to work, but you don't even protect them as they go to work. And as you see, it continues like this. I don't know. There are decisions that have to be taken by the state. Mm-hmm. For example, they are to ask the Ambazonia fighters to drop down their guns. They have created the DDR center. Yes, it's good. But what purpose? The centers have no curriculum. Those who have opted to drop their guns and go into the centers are on the streets every day protesting that if they knew, they would not have dropped their guns. There is nothing, a fix, like a program for these boys. Okay. I would expect the government to initiate transitional justice system, but the government is not ready to do anything, any of that. And at the end of it all, you still see that despite the colonial heritage we are fighting over today, this same colonial master, especially France, is still pulling the strings from behind.
Patricia, I'm going to give you the last word. Where can those of us who are watching this from the outside, where can we have the greatest impact with a desire to improve conditions and end the war in Cameroon?
I know there is a lot of work done on the ground against hate speech, but in a situation where even the government promotes the hate speech, what do you expect? People like you could help with maybe training, building capacities of different groups. I am currently working with a foundation in Germany to enhance my capacity in mediation. But the mediation cannot only be in my country. It can be because, of course, they will not accept, because Cameroon keeps saying that they are a sovereign state. And that is what destroys everything about willingness to make peace happen. Mm-hmm. So, but I think America is doing a great job to cause the government to really acknowledge that we have a problem. And but it should not only end with these circulars or notes, press releases. It should go with action. Until action happens, nothing. You see people just embezzle billions. And they are looking clearly in the faces of people when people have died. People are dying because of lack of basic, maybe hygiene instruments. People are dying. They don't have oxygen.
We have an acute humanitarian problem now in Cameroon. I think that is the most important aspect to tackle now, because it's total misery. It's total misery. I think if people have to intervene in Cameroon immediately, should be the humanitarian part of it before going into this conflict resolution. Because conflict resolution at this level, it has to go step by step. It's not something that will come immediately. It has to go step by step. So before step one, step two, step three, why don't we take care? Why don't we save lives? Why don't we make sure that children go back to school? Why don't we make sure that people that were shot get healed? We have to, the humanitarian aspect of it has to be speedy, the most speediest part of the impact we need in Cameroon. And then the other conflict resolution will take its normal steps in crisis zone. That is my opinion.
Thank you, Patricia. Let me just get in here, Duke. You know, conflict management and peace building is not an achievement. It's a process. There is always an argument what comes first. Yeah, everything exactly. is important at every time. So the humanitarian issue is part of relieving pain and suffering. And that is also part of the peace building process. Yes, it's part of the peace building process. Yes.
And I think that observation is a great place to end the conversation. Our guests today have been Dr. Patricia Asangwe. She's visiting lecturer at the National School of Administration and Magistry in Cameroon. Laura Atufam, consultant expert to conflict sensitivity for Catholic Relief Services, Caritas, and the Archdiocese of Bamenda.
When we come back, protests against violations of federalism agreements in Cameroon were met with state-led violence. What were the impacts of that? We'll hear from one of the organizers. Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Civil war in Cameroon continues with clashes between the Anglophone and Francophone populations. What led to the civil war and how can it be resolved? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In response to allegations of government infringement on the rights and the federalist system within Cameroon, activists in Anglophone Cameroon in what's known as Southern Cameroons, have organized peaceful resistance campaigns. These peaceful resistance campaigns have been met with violence, and many of the leaders have been targeted for arrest and imprisonment. One of those leaders is our guest, Dr. Fantem E. Neba. He was Secretary General of the Teachers Trade Union of the University of Buea before his arrest on the 17th of January, 2017. He was the Secretary General of the now banned Cameroon Anglophone Civil Society Consortium. And now he is in exile and serves as the Secretary General of the Southern Cameroons Alliance. He was also a professor of applied linguistics at the University of Buea, Cameroon, and the author of English Language Mastery and Academic Success. So Dr. Neba, thank you very much for joining us. First, you had organized for Anglophones in Cameroon advocating for human rights and political representation. What had motivated that organization?
Thanks for having me. At the time when we engaged the government, we had lived with we came into Cameroon in 1961 after a plebiscite, which required us to either join to independence by joining Cameroon or get our independence by joining the Federal Republic of Nigeria. We chose to join Cameroon and become a federated country. So we were actually the Federal Republic of Cameroon. And we had a federal constitution, which was not supposed to be touched. But unfortunately, we did not have a union treaty. So over time, the government of Cameroon abolished the federal system and created a United Republic. And with time, they abolished the United Republic and returned to a monolithic political system where our people lost their identity. Over the years, they began to absorb us, began to marginalize us, and pushed our people into poverty, misery, and deprivation. So at a certain point, we realized that even our educational system, our legal system, was being eroded. Our children did not have jobs after college. Our children were motorbike riders and they did all kinds of menial jobs. And so we as teachers and university professors, we came together and we said, no, we cannot be training our children and not seeing the fruit of our labor. So we engaged the government and said, there is a need to restore our cultural identity. First of all, our system needs to be revivified. Our children need to have jobs within our system, because we realized that Francophones were coming, Cameroon, were coming into our own territory, getting our jobs, teaching in our schools, and some of the teachers were teaching in a language that was not English. And so even admissions into medical schools, schools of engineering, in our own universities, our children were in the minority. And so we told the government to redress it. When we started the protest, the government ignored us, because we wrote to the government for several years and the government did not respond. And so we decided to declare an indefinite protest and ask all the parents to keep the children at home. And since Francophones citizens of French Cameroon had started sending their children into our own educational system, they were bound to be affected because there were no schools. And so they now had to address the issue. When they came to address the issue, we realized that they were not willing to get to the root of the matter, because corruption had been so entrenched that admissions into our own school were being sold for as much as $6,000 to read medicine, to read engineering, and the money was collected at the ministry under the control of the Minister of Higher Education himself. And so we insisted that the law must be respected. Universities must conduct their admissions without interference. The government was not willing to resolve these problems, so they turned around and arrested us. The lawyers had the same problem. Our legal system had gradually been eroded until we were now having French-speaking judges who were trained in the civil law system to administer common law. And it brought a lot of corruption. It brought a lot of unfortunate imprisonments and poor judgments. And so our lawyers insisted that there must be a redress of the wrongs. And as usual, the government started with the repression and arrests. So we decided to put our people together and formed what we called the Consortium of Civil Society Organizations, which brought together all unions. And I was the Secretary General of the consortium, because we realized that if we did not come together and bind in a consortium, the government was going to use divide and rule tactics, which was their strategy for 60 years, and fragment our quests and eventually bring us back to the starting point. And so that is how the civil society protest triggered off what has become a war today. Our people protested peacefully, but government decided to come in, the government of Cameroon decided to come in with violence. They used the army, they started killing to frighten people, it did not work. Then they started burning villages, they killed old people, killed the young, they killed women, and it has become a cycle.
The nature of the protest was, in essence, shutting down the schools, and I imagine there were also mobilization protests, et cetera. And then the government responded violently and specifically arrested a number of the leaders of the protest. Is that correct?
Yes, I was arrested. I was arrested on the 17th of January, 2 days after we had just had a meeting with the government. We had agreed on a number of things. We asked the government to sign an agreement with us to say that, yes, we have agreed on these issues. Our schools will run themselves. That there will be no more interference into the English educational system. There will be no this. We will follow the spirit of the law as it is written. We all agreed on those things, but the government refused to let us append our signature on the document. And we knew that if we did not append our signature on the document, the government would change the document later. Because even during the discussions, every time that we agreed on a point, we insisted that the document be reviewed from, we reread the document from the beginning so that we can recall everything that we have agreed on. But the government kept changing. Every time we reread a document, we realized that the government had changed some clauses. And so at the end of the day, we told them that we could not suspend our strike if we were not given room to sign the document and have a copy, because we needed it legally to back us and to justify to our constituency that on the basis of this agreement, we have now agreed that we will suspend our industrial action and give room for the government to begin implementation. But without that signature, we couldn't do it. So we told the government that if you don't want us to sign, then give us time to talk to our people that you don't want us to sign the document and let them decide whether we can suspend our strike or not. And they turned around and arrested us two, three days later. My car was burnt. My car was burnt. And we understand that it was the work of the government, because where I had parked my car before going to the meeting was on the campus of the University of Boya. But it was so done, it was done in such a way that the car was burnt, but the house next to which it was parked did not catch fire. So that is how the government started, and they started with a series of mass arrests. They arrested anyone who dared to talk about the conflict or who even texted a message. If they checked your phone and saw that you had any messages in your phone related to the protest, then you were going to be arrested. And the government's continuous use of force and the desire to enforce an arrest system whereby people had to bail themselves out caused the people to now look for means to defend themselves. Because the government came, for instance, they will come to your house, knock on your door, and if your 12, 13, 14-year-old son came to the door, they would arrest him and tell you to bring, if you're coming along, come with $500, about $500. If you don't pay $500 by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we are taking him to Yaoundé. And that is how a series of mass deportations began. And they started deporting children, young men and women from the English-speaking Southern Cameroons to the French-speaking Yaoundé. And that is how we have two prisons that are full of English-speaking Southern Cameroonians, and it has become a humanitarian problem.
And then in the Southern Cameroons, among the Anglophones, the decision then was made to shift from more nonviolent protests to more violent resistance and the Declaration of Independence in the region. How much has that complicated the potential for a resolution of this conflict?
The first thing I would like to say is that the government of Cameroon does not negotiate. They don't negotiate. If the government of Cameroon is talking to you, it is either you're going to give them money or you are in a position of weakness that will permit them to arrest you. And if they cannot arrest you, they are not going to talk with you. And if you're not going to give them money, then they are not going to talk with you. Or if you do not have the power to influence their getting money, then they don't have any business with you. Now, what happened was that the government of Cameroon, French Cameroon, decided, it's all started from corruption. The soldiers, those who were handling the conflict, started collecting money from the government because they needed mission allowances. This is a problem that could have been settled peacefully, and we were all disposed to a peaceful settlement. But some of the people in government underestimated the nature of the conflict and failed to realize that Southern Cameroonians had crossed a certain threshold of tolerance and patience. Because for all these years, they had been treated like underdogs, slaves, and given all kind of ridiculous names within the country. If somebody duped you, they would say that if anybody who was duped was treated as an English-speaking Cameroonian, they say, you think I'm an English, that's why you're duping me. So it means that they had successfully manipulated their way and considered us as fools. And there were even times that we were described as the enemy in the house. We were described as Trojan horses. So they even called us Biafrans and made it in such a way. We were called Biafrans. And the government has never for once apologized for all these ridiculous treatments. And at one point, we even realized that they had systematically avoided teaching their children the history of the country so that French Cameroonian children grew up knowing that we, the English speaking Cameroonians, came to Cameroon because there was war in Nigeria and Cameroon gave us land. And now we have come in and we want to take over their country. And that's why whenever we had a protest, whenever Southern Cameroonians or English-speaking Cameroonians protested at any time, they were told to go back to their country, go back to your country. Why did you come here? So you can imagine living under those conditions for all those years. Some of our parents went through that humiliation and died miserably. So when we sat down and looked at what was going on, we were bound to protest at some point. Now, what escalated the conflict was the military violence. Too many innocent people were being killed and too many innocent young men were being arrested. And at some point, coupled with the poverty, the people had to reach for what they had to defend themselves. When the government started killing them, they reached for Dane guns. Dane guns are naturally local guns which use gunpowder. They use gunpowder and they are used for traditional ceremonies. So actually they are not lethal weapons. So you use them for the ceremony because what matters is the noise that it produces. But eventually, as the government became ferocious in its attacks and started their scorched earth policy, burning down villages, the young men had to reach for their grandparents' ceremonial guns. And that is how the resistance began.
You were arrested, you were imprisoned, and you're currently in exile from your home. Has this resistance and the role that you've played, has it been worth it? Have you seen potential for real change as a result of the sacrifices you've made?
Yes, there is a potential for change. There is a potential for change. And there is a potential for change, and especially with the new role that I'm playing now. I've played several roles. I have tried to put together some of the leaders of organizations in the liberation movement to see how they can work collectively to be able to achieve a common goal, because unity of purpose is essential to causes like ours. I have also worked in the humanitarian domain to give collecting support, clothes, medicine, financial assistance, and sending it to refugees who are in Nigeria or internally displaced persons, prisoners in dungeons in Yaoundé and in Douala and other parts of the country. So I have been making my own contribution, and currently I am the Secretary General of the Southern Cameroons Alliance, which brings together experts, professionals, politicians, civil society people, and all those who are willing to put aside their personal differences to work together for a common cause. We are working with international stakeholders to ensure that the people of Southern Cameroons have the opportunity to express themselves and choose how they want to live as the United Nations defines self-determination. So because we cannot, if we must resolve this problem, we must go to the root of the matter. And we are totally committed to talking, having dialogue with with the government of Cameroon, but unfortunately they have not indicated. But since 2019, our people have been clamoring for dialogue, because no matter what happens, we are still going to be either neighbors or something else. Depending on how what the outcome will be, but the people should be able to determine how they want to live in their country, whether they want to live as slaves or they want to live as free people. So essentially, the Southern Cameroons Alliance is working to obtain truth, justice, and freedom for the people of Southern Cameroons. And the effort that I have put in so far, I am very optimistic that even if the world does not actually really understand what is going on, they will come to understand and realize that the plight of the people is worth giving attention to, and the solution will come.
And hopefully your testimony and today's show will at least elevate the visibility of this conflict that sadly many in the United States know terribly little about. So thank you very much for joining us. We've been discussing the ongoing crisis and civil war in Cameroon, in particular in Southern Cameroons. Our guest has been Dr. Fantem E. Neba. He was Secretary General of the Teachers Trade Union of the University of Bouea before his arrest on the 17th of January, 2017. He was the Secretary General of the now banned Cameroon Anglophone Civil Society Consortium. And now he is in exile and serves as the Secretary General of the Southern Cameroons Alliance. He was also a professor of applied linguistics at the University of Bouea, Cameroon. A special note, today's show has given us voices from Cameroon, scholars and activists. And in particular, I'd like to thank Debbie McCormick and her tireless work in publicizing this crisis and her invaluable assistance in helping to organize today's panels.
Thank you to our guest and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.